One though. Yeah. It's gorgeous, yeah. Yeah. Just a minute, please. Oh, yeah, that's just so amazing. Yeah. Sahana Bhavatu,
Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Dreams, nightmares. Why do we feel so powerless in our dreams compared to real life? Yet dreams are much more intense. How do we deal with traumatic dreams? Well, we are, in a sense, powerless in our dreams because the karta, there's no doership in the dream. There's only enjoyership. So you're not really making decisions in the dream, you're experiencing the dream without really even any free will or what we call kartatvami, any doership. And so the experiences, and sometimes, as we were saying yesterday, very scary experiences come in the dream, and they also set off adrenaline and all kinds of emotions in our physical body. There's not much we can do about it. In fact, if you semi wake up from a dream state, you can't move because the dream state actually paralyzes the whole body. In fact, if it didn't do that as you're dreaming, your body would be going all over the place, right? Which happens at times. That's a disorder, actually. So you're just physically immobilized when you're dreaming, and there's no doership in the dream, and so it's just whatever the experience is. And there's not... Sometimes if you can do lucid dreaming, you have some control over it because you're partially awake. But if you're not partially awake, you don't have, you're not in that liminal state. It's just an experience. And so that's why sometimes when you wake up, you're so relieved. I've had that kind of a dream where something was awful happening in the dream that would have big repercussions of sorts. And when I woke up and realized it was only a dream, it was such a relief that that didn't really happen. Anyway. On the other hand, you know, when you are awake and you remember the dream, you can actually, just like how we're kind of doing active imagination and inner child work and going into the unconscious, you can actually recall the dream, the image of the dream. Like, say there's something in particular about the dream you wanted to know or you wanted to move it forward. You can actually go back into that dream, you know, and meet the dream character or characters, or put yourself in that dream situation and ask questions and go into dialogue, and those characters will talk to you. And you can even go in and say the dream ended abruptly. And then have you ever had that experience where it ended and you think, oh no. And then you try to go back to sleep and see if you can get it back. You know, usually you're not able to do that. But you can, in the imaginal world, go back, evoke that dream state, that ending state, and then talk to those characters and say, I woke up, what happened? You know, or push it forward. So that's something really interesting for you to take advantage of, to play with if you're so inclined. When we know that the love we feel is a projection of the love inside, why having relationships and marriage? Because that's the nature of the creation. You know, that's the nature of things. So that, you know, that connection, that attraction, that falling in love phenomena, that the bliss bubble, you know, wonderful bliss bubble that just puts you, it's just totally unreal. You're just in a bubble. But that bubble is so beautiful. You know, and it gives you a chance to just fall in love with each other and be overwhelmed by the love that you have and all of that. And that gives you some strength to handle the reality when the bliss bubble goes away. And it's just the two of you, you know. And then when it's just the two of you, then you can really, you have that kind of positive transference, and then you can see, can we manage in the world? Do we have enough in common to really be together, you know? And so that's something that we discover over time. You know? So anyway, it's all of these things, if I say bliss bubble and this incredible act of falling in love, and that's Ishwara. That's Bhagavan. That's what he's done to allow that for procreation and all of that. And then just, it's also, you know, having a child takes two people, you know? And then the family structure is there, and the family structure goes way back, as far back as you can go, as far back as there's human beings that we know. Even animals have family structure. They have very serious family structure. They have friends, you know. Rats are monogamous. Huh? Yeah. Yeah. They're very good parents to their children. So it's part of the creation, you know. And so even when you have knowledge and you recognize the source of the whole creation is your own being and the Ananda is yourself, still, from a relative standpoint, I am here and you are there. And from within the creation, there's still, you know, attraction and falling in love and getting married. These are all archetypes. Archetypes means they're like the instincts of the psyche. Sometimes they're talked about like the instincts of the psyche. So to have relationships, to have children, to have family. And also, archetypal, is to be alone, to be monks, to be spiritual seekers. That's all also an archetype. You know? For some people who take to a life of sannyasa, there's an archetype for that, you know. But the most common and what really keeps the humanity thriving and growing is the family structure. Culture growing is the family structure. But it's all archetypal, so it's Ishwara. So it's more like asking, why is Ishwara like that? Ishwara also doesn't need anything. Ishwara is Brahman, and it's everything. So why does the creation have all of this these relationships? Because it does. Because that's the nature of the creation. There is no why. You can think of all kinds of reasons within inside of it, but the whole creation comes in that form. Something that all human beings share, all living beings share. So we're even finding out that plants have deep relationships and are talking to each other through their root systems. And they're also, the plants also are emitting often scents when other animals and other beings are going to be threatened by somebody, some interloper that's coming into their space. They will send out warning signals, usually in the form of scent. So the more we study, the more we recognize even the most, what we would call basic levels of consciousness. That's us talking. That's not, a plant's not going to say, you know, I just have the most basic level of consciousness. It will consider itself as what it is, you know. So arrogant. You can be so arrogant. It's really good to study and lose all of that. So yeah, but love the things as they are. You know, so I think that's all I can think about that. How is the power of the karma exhausted? Is it through living the life, experience what needs to be experienced, or is it exhausted in a way out of free will, for example, dealing with attachments, raga, dveshas? Now, the prarabdha is exhausted by living it. In fact, that's the only way it's exhausted, because once with the prarabdha karma, what that means is the sanchitta karmas, which are all the karmas from beginningless time, for in reference to yourself, that have not yet exhausted in the form of punya and papa, manifest in the prarabdha karma. Once those karmas have kicked into place with your birth and will go all the way through to your death, the prarabdha karma exhausts itself as it's experienced. That's what it is. And during that experience, you're accruing karmas, new karmas called agami karmas, those which are coming, they're being born, agami. So those karmas will be stored in the sanchitta until the results, the karmapala, the punya and papa of those karmas have a place to exhaust in the form of the prarabdha karma. So the free will doesn't... What the free will has to do is that how am I... In this stream of life, my life, called the prarabdha karma, within that unfoldment of the life, I have free will to choose, to make choices. It's limited because the free will is never separate from the prarabdha karma, right? Because the prarabdha karma is what is actually here, the general flow of experience. But within the general flow of the experience of your life, you do have free will, you have choice. And you have the ability to assimilate, you have intelligence, the ability to assimilate your experience, and then to gain a value, to become a mumukshu, desire to gain moksha, the desire to neutralize your likes and dislikes. But the desire to neutralize the raga dveshas, the likes and dislikes, comes from really an assimilation of experience. Otherwise, why would you want to neutralize them? The likes are the way you get what you want to make that will make you happy. And the dislikes are how to keep things away, you know, that won't make you happy. So there's an assimilation of experience that causes you to not have as your primary goal satisfying just your likes and dislikes. It becomes really dharma, or it becomes a life of giving, or a life of a life that allows you to have shanti in your mind instead of chasing after all of these things that are disruptive actually to your shanti. And the neutralization of likes and dislikes has very much to do with gaining self-knowledge, so that my mind, enjoying my own being, can objectively experience and be with the world. And objectively, it doesn't mean like a walking head or something with no emotions. It's not at all what it means. It means that I can be fully present. I can be fully present to the world, and am not always seeing it out of the overwhelm of an emotion. You know, because enjoying my own ananda, I can be with you as you are and appreciate that. So it means you can actually have the freedom to be much more engaged in the world. And also, you know, that the verse that we just did, that kind of where your successes and defeats, if they're the same for you in the sense that they don't cause some big reaction. Of course, they're not the same thing, you know. You're successful in something, or that thing totally flops or fails. Those two things are different outcomes, right? But what is the same is how you are with it. That prasada buddhi, you know, that being able to be with this experience, the salt and pepper, sometimes we call it, and chilies, salt and peppers and chilies and lemons and all these flavors. You're able to be present because you're not at stake. And so then you can fully experience. Even when we're teaching this inner child work and dealing with these emotions and welcoming them, you know, you're able to fully do that because there's a inviolate self inside that just receives them and heals them rather than becomes over, yourself doesn't become overwhelmed by anything. And so as that knowledge starts to become strong, become clear, then the more and more brave you are in the sense of being able to really be present to all of your feelings, good and bad, and let them come, welcome them to just be there with you. And in that welcoming, they relax, and the charge that they're carrying dissipates, and then you become objective, because then you're speaking and being from yourself, not from the emotional state.
Can I continue on that? I've been thinking about the same concept, dharma and karma, and the way I see it in my inner eye is karma is action driven by fear or likes and dislikes. So it's not so much, you were talking before about dharma as universal moral. But I simplify it inside myself and see like my actions driven by unconscious fear, likes or dislikes, in this one word, fear, is karma, creates more karma, new karma. While if I have my actions connected in love, or my true self, or Ishvara, that's automatically dharma. So it's in my heart, I don't see it as a law outside or a moral that is a set of rules. It's more a standpoint in me from where my actions arise. Do you see?
I totally agree also, because actually love itself, you know, is the very swarupa of Ishwara and of myself. And so when the actions that are take are coming out of that, are coming out of that love, then that's objective, because you don't have to be a particular way, and it doesn't have to turn out in a particular way.
And it can be the exact same action. You know, it can be actually the physical same thing that I'm doing. I'm walking across the street in fear. It's karma. I'm walking across the street in love, or originating that actions from love. It's dharma. I'm slapping someone in the face from fear. It's karma. I'm slapping someone in the face out of love, you know, to wake them up to whatever.
Bring them back to consciousness.
Bring them back to consciousness. It's the same action, but it's a different.
The motivation is different.
Yeah, or it's a standpoint from where I'm doing it is different.
Yeah. So yeah, okay. That's it. Yeah. I agree.
Okay.
When sometimes when we're talking about the laws, there's scientific laws, they're the order. Sometimes we use, instead of laws, we use the order. And so Ishwara's order is Dharma, but we don't look at it as a set of laws. And when you're talking about it personally, I think that's very beautiful, actually. Yeah, I understand. Sometimes when they're talking about karma and karmapala, okay, these two words, I do a particular karma in order to get a particular result. They would say, just kind of in the tradition, then that action isn't really an action which is free of karma in the sense of karmapala. Because sometimes when we use the word karma, we mean karmapala. So I'm accruing karma, right? Because I'm doing this particular action in order to gain a karmapala. Like, for a common example, like if I'm doing puja to Ishwara and I'm praying to Bhagavan and doing the puja with all love and shraddha, but I am doing the puja so that I can go to Swargaloka. That's one thing. Or I could be doing the puja so that I could get a better next birth. Or I could be doing the puja for Antakarna Shuddhi. And so when you're doing the puja for Antakarna Shuddhi, then that's not considered a karmapala. That what I'm working for is for my mind to gain the shanti. And praying for the shanti so that I can gain this knowledge. So they make distinctions like that. So it's a little just different, talking about it in a different way than what you're saying. But I agree with what you're saying. But that's one way of talking about it that is beautiful. And you can trust it, in a sense, you know. Because if you're acting out of love or care, even if it doesn't work out, but that's, it's not about it working out or not working out. That's the last verse. It's not about that. It's not about attaining something or not attaining it. It's about where you're coming from in the action. You know. So if you're coming from a place of love, then it's Dharma. Because that's the very nature of your Swarupa, that type of thing. So that's beautiful. Makes sense?
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Could you give some example or contextualize what it is not to flee from the dharmic war in the lives we are living? Oh, in these lives now? Oh, yeah, that's a biggie. Well, actually, I think one way to think about that I personally find helpful is that within your prarabdha karma, you know, you have a sphere of influence. Sometimes we say Swamiji has a really big footprint in terms of his sphere or of influence or what comes to him to do. Right? The footprint is huge. Things are coming from all over. You know, people asking for help for this or asking him to get involved in this organization or to do this or to do that. And so there, in his life, and I mean in all of us, we probably have different footprints, you know. But opportunities are given to us to where we can help, you know, or that we can do something to help another person or another institution or something that is good that we're happy to be able to do because it will make a difference in some way or another in terms of Dharma. It's a contribution to the well-being of other people and to the animals and to the earth. It's a contribution. Things come, we have opportunities to make those contributions. You know? But there are opportunities that come to us that we can make. And then there's probably billions of opportunities that exist in the world, but they're not within your sphere. And I think that sometimes from people that I know, they have a problem with that because they feel like the opportunities that are there available to them are too small. they're too small, it's not enough, but I should be able to do more. But you kind of have to jump out of your own skin into somebody else's skin to be able to do that, or into somebody else's prarabdha. So I think it has to do with making use of the opportunities that you have to give and to help. And the other thing, you know, every person that you help or are kind to or whatever, seems like simple things, it makes such a difference to that person. Because think of your own life. People do just some simple little thing, but they do some kindness to you, you know, and you don't forget it, you know. I've often told the story that this was probably around, gosh, it must be 30 or 40 years ago, and I haven't forgotten it at all. I used to teach in San Francisco, and then Edward would usually take me from Berkeley. And then afterwards, I really liked to go to this little restaurant right on the sea, overlooking the ocean. And in this little, it's just a little like coffee shop, just a little simple little coffee shop. And I used to love to go because of this one waitress. And this waitress was wild. She had these, she always had these big red flowers in her hair. And she looked like a gypsy, you know. She looked like a gypsy, and she'd have these colorful full skirts on. But when you would come in, she remembered all of her customers, you know. And when you'd come in, she'd say, "Oh, honey. I'm so glad to see you. You two come over here. Do you want the same thing?" And then she remembered our menu and said, "You want this? We want this again? You want this? Let me get it for you. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, she was so real. You know, it wasn't pretend at all. It wasn't like she was trying to be a gypsy or something. Mm-hmm. This is just who she was, and she was so warm, and she was so kind, and she made your day, you know. And I saw her do it to everybody. And so people just loved to be there so that they could, you know, be served, taken care of by her for that short little period of time. Because she cared, you know. You could say, "Oh, she's just a waitress." You know. But she's just a beautiful person, is what she is. And she's a beautiful person, and she just touches your heart. And you don't forget, you know. And then I think, I wonder what she's doing now. Because you don't forget, you know. One time, another thing I remember about, again, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, I was working I was a therapist, and I had my office in San Francisco. And so I used to teach at the school, and then I would drive over and find some parking somewhere, and then walk to work to my office. And so I was walking along, not too far from my office, and this old man who's had a cane, you know, he came walking, and he's very tall and kind of dignified and quite old. Maybe he was in his late 70s or something, or early 80s, but he was still dignified, and his cane was beautiful, he was very well dressed. And he walks along, and he passes me, he starts to pass me, and then he puts his hand out, and he goes, "Madam, I just want you to know what a beautiful woman you are." I didn't consider myself as some beauty. I'm not any beauty queen. Nevertheless, the way he said that, "Madam, you're such a beautiful woman. I'm so happy to just have this moment with you." Something like that, he said. And then I thought, wow, that little few seconds, it's just happened. I mean, it was less than a minute, honestly. But you know what? It was like a blessing. It was just so sweet. It was so nice, you know? And people don't come up and say things to you like that normally, right? You don't. But that was just an act of love and giving and reaching out in this way. And I don't even remember what I said. I probably said, "Oh, thank you so much," or something like that, you know. But these, I mean, I probably all have these memories of these wonderful little moments, And they count. You know, they really count. They really matter. And so we want to have a big footprint, but that's a pretty big footprint, you know. Swamiji once said, but I really thought about this to see if I really agreed with it. What he said is, even if you help one student, even if you give knowledge to one student, your life is worthwhile. Your life is a success. Something like that, he said, you know. And then I thought, well, you know, if I were Swamiji's only student, you know, and he gave knowledge to me, that would really be worthwhile. That would be worth it. Just think about it. It sounds kind of, I don't know how to make that sound as real as it is, but say there was somebody, and the only person, for whatever reasons, they were able to teach and give self-knowledge was to you. That's all. Would their life be worthwhile? You know? And when you think about it from your own standpoint, I would say, yes, it's really is very worthwhile because you gave me self-knowledge. You know? So think about that. What that means. I don't even know what it means, but it really means something. And because it's serious, it's not pretend. It's like, yes. Yes, that really means something. That you gave me self-knowledge, even if I was the only one, that would really mean something, you know? And I'm not talking from the standpoint of, well, I have such a high value of myself that, of course, if you just gave me self-knowledge, that would be fine. That's not what I mean at all. I mean, it's true for any one of us. You know, so that's not a very big footprint, but it's a huge footprint. You know, that's how much each person matters. Each person matters. It's an amazing thing. You know, it's worth how much it is worth. One person is worth. You know. He said it. I thought about it. That gives it some objective stance. Some of these things you have to think about for a while, because it's really like that one. It's really very moving when you understand, you know. And it also takes away completely the idea of a footprint, that you have to have a big or small footprint. Yeah. And what one act of kindness to one being means. Just one act of kindness to one being, let alone giving knowledge. It's very beautiful. Do all natural laws such as gravity, speed of light, etc., come from Ishwara's dream? How could we? I'm not sure what that word says. How could we something that? It looks complicated. Well, the universe is infinitely complex. We can't even imagine the level of complexity from the standpoint of our minds. I think maybe we had this question before. Right? I think we had this question before. Not tonight, but just got back in the box, I think. Ishwara's dream is not exactly the same. If you wanted to say Ishwara's dream, it would be more like a lucid dream because there's no jnanam there. So it's like if I projected my maya into the form of the creation, I'm not asleep, right? It's just that I have that maya as a capacity. It projects. I'm totally myself, and the creation is there, and it enjoys my being completely. That would be more Ishwara. And so all of what we discover in our science and math and all of these things, we continually discover the order and all of the laws and the complexity of all of the laws. But that's from the standpoint of a jiva going into it, and it's infinitely complex. Like as somebody said, you know, you could spend your whole life analyzing a leaf because of the extreme complexity and layers of interrelationship that's going on in just one leaf. You know, so you could take your whole life, and then there'd be more. You know, so there's no way we can really comprehend the level of complexity, but from Ishwar's standpoint, I remember kind of saying, it's probably not complex at all, it's just the way it is. It's the nature of the universe. From our standpoint, it's very complex as we go on, you know, analyzing it, but from the standpoint of Ishwar, it's just, boom, it's there. It's a manifestation of absolute infinite knowledge, but it's not like he built it stone by stone. It just is there. And then we recognize the infinite complexity and infinite intelligence of it when we start to, you know, analyze it and observe it. Okay. When one has worked a lot to comfort one's inner children, does it then become more natural to have energy and love to give to others? I can imagine that one's own inner children will try to get one's attention in different ways that may make it harder to focus on others in a genuine way. For example, I can see the difference when people help others out of guilt and not out of love, which often makes them complain about needing to help, not just do it because they want to. Okay. So this first part, when one has worked a lot to comfort one's inner children, does it then come more natural to have energy and love to give to others? Yeah, and in different ways also, because how I treat myself on a deep level is what I know how I treat others too. You know, and so if the way you hold your own psyche, your own, you know, bumblings and everything that goes on in the conscious world and in the inner world, if I'm somebody who's welcoming and accommodating and gives the benefit of the doubt to myself and wants to help when if I make a mistake or if I'm hurt or whatever, that I'm there to help, then that's the way I most likely am with others too. You know, it's when I'm harboring a lot of hurt and anger inside that hasn't been released and processed that kind of those kind of feelings get projected out. Like, for instance, say I have in my childhood history, I have a very violent or angry father. And so in the father-daughter, father-child relationship, then interjected is this mean, angry father and this frightened, you know, or hurt child. And so that's introjected, internalized in many, many different ways. And then what happens in the world is because if I haven't processed that and brought that dyad into consciousness and released that energy and then brought that little girl out there, you know, in a loving way, then what happens is either of this dyad, the father-child, I become the child and somebody else becomes the father, as though the father gets projected onto the mean, violent father gets projected onto the other person, and I become like the hurt child, or awful as it is, I become the mean, angry father, and this person out here gets the projection, I get the projection overwhelmed, my buddhi gets overwhelmed by the mean, angry father, and the person out here becomes the victim that the mean, angry father is attacking, so to speak. And so then I'm always having to deal with pains and hurts and anger and the perpetrators as though, and the perpetrator-victim model, you know. I'm taking one position or another. And so that's not, I'm not always loving and kind. But when I'm not loving and kind, which is really your nature, there's something going on inside, you know, because you can be a little irritated and whatnot, but if it's a big thing, something's usually being triggered. And so a really good idea when that's taking place, when you're feeling like really angry, or you just ask yourself, just pull back for a minute and say, what's going on? You know, what are you really angry about? And then just go inside a little bit and see what's happening. Or when you're projecting that somebody's really hates you or doesn't like you or is angry at you or, you know, whatever it happens to be, then you say, you know, what's going on? What are you really feeling? What is that about? And then if you have a good that inner child relationship, is if you're used to it, I'll probably tell you, you know. Oh, nobody ever loved me. Dad never loved me. Or something. I'll say something. That'll take it back to the unconscious. And really doesn't have much to do with that person at all. It's just there's just a trigger for the projection. And so when we are doing our own work and working with those dyads and also starting to work with our relationship with others outside, we will do some of that in the meditation we do every year, actually, and we'll do some this year when we're working with our different people in our group of friends and family that are hard for us. And then you'll see, you know, what's getting projected on that person, what's getting projected on you and buddhi. So doing that inner work really, really, really helps in terms of giving you an objective way of being with people that's not, doesn't have a big snake laid on, you know what I mean. And I also feel that this, so I can imagine that one's own inner children will try to get one's attention in different ways. That can be true initially, but when you've done that work, they grow up. The little ones grow up and they join you. They catch up with your age and their energy just, and that part of you that's been kind of split off and kept in the unconscious, just kind of like homeopathy. It just comes back into your own psyche and blesses you and becomes part of yourself. And initially, you forget about it, but initially when a little broken-off piece, if I can use this language, a little broken-off piece rejoins, you feel her or him. You feel her now as part of you. You know, it's really beautiful. And then that feeling goes away because she's just you, you know. But initially, you feel her presence in your conscious mind. Just subtle and beautiful. So then they're not asking for attention because they've gotten the attention they need and they were able to grow up. Just like little children who want so much attention, always to be really the center of attention, because that's what little children do, you know. But when they get to be the center of attention, one of my psychologist professors said, he was just had a little boy, he said, you just have to fill them up with love. Just hold them and fill them up with love. So, you know, so they have that inside, they have that solid structure inside where they feel love, they feel they have natural self-esteem, they don't feel like they're not worthwhile or they're not good enough. All of these, it's just deprivation, childhood deprivation, and it goes with you. So you have to re-raise those parts so that you don't think about being worthwhile or not worthwhile. It's just a non-issue, you know, or that you're loved or not loved. So if you never feel loved, which is kind of a disease of our psychological pain of our time, you know, feel deeply, you know, nobody really loves me. That feeling is not there, you know. And so you don't feel, oh, everybody loves me. That's also a narcissistic, what do you call it? Compensation for not feeling like, oh, everybody loves me. Everybody thinks I'm really wonderful. No, they don't. They don't think anything. But we don't. But when these things are settled in you, you don't think about being loved or not loved. You just are loved. You know, you don't think about if this person loves me or that person loves me. It's a non-issue. Because that structure has healed the psyche, the structure of the psyche. Yeah, this thing when people, I can see the difference when people help others out of guilt and not out of love, which often makes them complain about needing to help, not just to do it because they want to. Yeah, those are all. Guilt is, especially if you pick up guilt when you're little, guilt and shame, it's not really fair for a little child to feel guilty. you know, and to internalize guilt. Poor thing. I mean, and guilt's a hard one to get rid of, you know. The guilt is, I did something wrong, you know. I hurt somebody, I did something wrong. Shame is more, I'm not okay. There's something wrong with me. Guilt is, I did something wrong, you know. But do you make a little child feel guilty when they make a mistake or do something? It's just a learning experience. Why would they have to feel guilty, you know, and then internalize that and have to grow up feeling guilty, I did something wrong, because that guilt keeps getting triggered. Guilt's a really a hard one. If you're picking it, yeah, that's so cute. If you pick up guilt and when you're an adult because you did something and you feel really, really guilty and really bad about it, Swamiji once said that guilt never goes away. That I'm not talking about childhood guilt, but say if you did something or behaved in a way or didn't do something and you feel guilty about that, you know, you may always feel guilty about it. Because I know I have a handful of things that I've never forgotten that I wish I feel badly about it. I wish I would have done this instead of that, or I wish I would have given more care in this situation. I've got three or four things that I know I'll never forget. It's not that I go around feeling guilty all the time, but I'll never forget, you know. And I was really, I never really thought about it until Swamiji talked about it. Time, because probably the same for him. He probably has a couple of things where he really should have done something, feels he really should have done something or handled something differently, and it probably really caused some problem for the other person or hurt the other person, you know, or whatever it is. But you just, you don't forget. Because it's not going to be a little thing, it's something that matters. So I thought that's interesting, but that's different than being made to feel guilty when you're a little child, you know. Then you have to go inside and tell that little one, you're not guilty. You're a good girl. You didn't do anything. You may have made a mistake, but then you can learn from that. Not guilty. You're not a guilty girl. You're not a guilty boy. You know? You have to convince them. It could be a huge burden to carry. In the understanding that we are in a beginningless and endless reality, how can the different yugas begin and end? There's different stories about, well, not stories exactly, in the whole mythology or whatever you want to call it, the whole history that discusses all of that. There are yugas and mahayugas, and there's different types of cycles where there's a complete pralaya, where the whole creation goes into an unmanifest condition, and then there's different types of where there's not a complete one. So I don't understand all of that well, but one, I don't see it that one yuga brings about the movement of in from one yuga into another yuga. Doesn't bring about the end of the previous yuga. It's just a slow, subtle transformation moving from one yuga into the other. So you go through all four, and then you have that complete cycle. And that cycle is what sometimes brings about the whole creation coming into unmanifest condition, as opposed to there being a movement, a different kind of movement. And so that's where I get confused. I'd have to read it and study it. Even if I were to teach that, I couldn't just extemporaneously talk about it. I would have to go back to the books and see, okay. And then it gets confusing, so I'd probably bring all my notes with me and read it to you, because it's confusing. It's almost different levels of mathematics in a way. So it's interesting. But you can probably go to Wikipedia. They have a lot of this kind of stuff on Wikipedia. Not that you can trust Wikipedia completely, but you can't. But still, they do have a lot that can give you an idea.
I think me and Pelle actually read about this in school this spring.
You did?
Yeah, when we were reading about Hinduism, that when all the yugas are passed, basically the universe is done and begins anew.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. There's a one when the cycle is done, the universe goes into what we call pralaya.
Yeah.
Means it goes into complete unmanifest condition. But that's called a Mahayuga. When it goes in the complete unmanifest condition, then there are cycles within that, and that's what I can't tell you about.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Because I don't remember how it all goes. How can we introduce Vedanta or the Vedantic model to our children? Well, one of the most real things is that you yourself are a role model. You know, you're a role model. And so the way that you treat them, the way that you hold them, the way that you are with your own mind and your own reactions and, you know, your value system, that's the strongest. That's like through osmosis they take in all of that, and they take in that structure that you have, not even consciously, unconsciously. So that's probably the strongest way. And then when they're young, you can read them, you know, I'm just telling you different ideas. You can read them some of these comic books. The kids love them. They're all the stories that you can find in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. And they all have really nice kind of messages that I think are really good for adults and for children in terms of how to be with your mind and what really is Dharma, you know, and how to have emotions and to be a human being, how to be with a whole gamut of thoughts and not think you're only supposed to have good thoughts. You know, to be a good person, you have to have good thoughts. If you have bad thoughts, you're not a good person. That's an awful thing, you know. We tell the story of Jimmy Carter, who I really think he's a good man. I respect him a lot. But he had an adulterous thought of his wife, and he never forgot it because it was such a terrible thought to have. He should be a better person than to have that thought. And so he carried it as a heavy load. So probably that's kind of very Christian, at least in the more middle-age Christianity than from the Middle Ages. The negative, bad thoughts, evil thoughts, were really from Satan. And the good thoughts are from God. And so if you're having bad thoughts, then you're under the influence, a satanic influence, and which is not good. That means, you know, you're one of his people, not one of God's people. You know. But that creates just this huge pressure in the mind in terms of the type of thoughts that you have, you know. So to really understand Dharma has to do with how you are with your thoughts and feelings, how you act it out. That's Dharma. The thoughts and feelings are just like scenery. You know, they come from everywhere and anywhere. You're taking in hundreds and hundreds, so on thousands. There's countless input, countless data coming in all of the time. And that which comes in is going to come out. But what if you take it all to be you, you know? And you learn how to just let thoughts go. That aren't worthwhile. You know, you don't act them out. You have the freedom to let them go. That's Dharma. And you have the freedom to act on them, you know. The Dharma is what your choices are there. And another thing I think about reading these comic books or some of the stories is that they portray men and women both in a way that is beautiful and sane, where a man is allowed to be gentle and have the whole gamut of emotions. You know, and we tend to be the feminine, the masculine side are very well balanced for a man. And for a woman also, a woman is a devi, you know, that they're not just male gods, masculine gods. There's many, many, every masculine god has a feminine counterpart. You know, that makes a, psychologically, that makes a big difference, you know. And to be an intelligent, capable woman that other people count on and depend on, you know, other than just being, you know, a housewife, which is also a beautiful thing. But what if all women are, that's what you are. You are a housewife. That's not right, you know. You may do all kinds of things to take care of the family and to take care of the house, and you do a lot of other things too, you know. And men should also have a wide range, and that's portrayed so beautifully. When I was probably 23 or 24 when I read the whole Mahabharata in the Ramayana when I was in India. It was such a relief because everyone, men and women, were allowed to be whole beings, and men and women are represented in the, you know, in the as the devatas. It's not just masculine, it's feminine also. That makes a huge difference, especially for little girls, you know. Men already have that, but then they're so cut off from the feminine, so they are hurting also, very badly actually. And women are also hurting. But when I read this, there was a certain wholeness that is given to us. And so I think those things really help. And then you'll find naturally as the kids get older that there's little stories you can tell them, little things that you can point out, you know. And they can notice little things about their mind. Like when they're in nature, how beautiful their mind is, how quiet and how everything shines and sparkles, you know. How it makes you feel when you're kind to your friend. Just little things. Dharma oriented, and the parents should be oriented. You know? Talking about God is always being present, looking after you, not looking at you. I'm going to start so I can get.
Om Swasti Prajapyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Gobrahmanegya Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamcho Parahitaha Ramana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukkha Bhavet Asato Ma Satkamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om